Hi, this is Andrew.
And this is Amy. And in this episode, AADL talks to longtime Ann Arbor News photographer Larry E. Wright.
Larry talks with us about being mentored by chief photographer Cecil Lockhart, life in a daily newspaper, and how sometimes a photographer's most valuable piece of equipment is his personality.
Hi, Larry.
Hello there, Amy. How you doing?
So we know that Cecil Lockhart hired you.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit how you got from, and that you went to Pioneer High School. Mm-hmm. You grew up in Ann Arbor. Could you tell us how you got your job at the news? How did you start your interest in photography, and how did it lead you there?
Okay. From a young age, as a kid, I've always had an interest in visual communications. That's what I'll call it. Later on, photography was my bread and butter. I would run around the neighborhood as a young teenager with a 8mm camera doing movies and a Kodak Instamatic camera doing stills. And I would take my stuff over to Ivory Photo, which mm-hmm. is no longer there. Mm-hmm. There's an apartment building there. Ivory Photo was at the bottom of Main and Madison. Mm-hmm. And have my black and whites done there and have them do a contact sheet for me. Then where Pretzel Bell is at this present day, when I was a kid coming up, it was Cunningham's. And they did color. Well, they sent it. You take it and fill out your envelope, put your film in there, and they send it off a week later or so. It comes back. You go pick it up and pay for it and so forth. And I was a member of a teen council at the Ann Arbor Community Center. And Cecil Lockhart noticed me, you know, going around taking pictures of my friends and activities that we were doing. And so we got to talking. And so that's how we got to know each other. And he noticed a talent that I had, a talent for just, you know, getting shots. And he could work with me. And so I started off working with him when he would shoot the Michigan football games. And I would keep track of his pictures. So I would record what frames. He'll tell me that was frame number 18 or so forth, which I'm sure cut down on his time looking for particular shots that he think he has gotten once he gets into the darkroom and develops the film. And then around the fourth quarter or so, when he felt that he had enough shots, he'd tell me I can pull my camera out and I can get a few shots. And then he would take my film and he would process it when he get back. And then when I come up there and meet with him and stuff, he would show me, he'd make a contact sheet and he would show me my stuff and how I was doing and that type of thing. I've always, like I said, I started out with video and all of that, well, 8mm cameras, but I've always had an interest in that. We had an Argus camera, one of those twin lens Arguses. Ooh. Oh, man. And so big flash bulbs and all that. So there's a lot of pictures in the album, photo album at home that I had taken through the years with that big Argus. But also I had an interest in underwater photography. So later on in years at the Ann Arbor News, I got certified as a scuba diver because one of my heroes was the late Jacques Cousteau, the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau. And Sea Hunt with Lloyd Bridges. I used to watch that show. And, you know, some of this stuff for some of your listeners is going to be kind of foreign to them because when I mention certain names, you're like, okay, but look it up, y'all. You can Google it. And so working with Cecil, and when he shot Michigan basketball, I was there and I was keeping his stats, doing the same thing. And then somewhere along the second half, I'd start shooting, and he'd take the film back and process it and show me some stuff. Then he also was teaching a class out at community high school. But by this time, I'm out of school and working for an agency of the city called Model Cities. It served a certain designated community area in Ann Arbor, federally funded. And I was putting out a newspaper called The Write-On and doing local stories about the local merchants, the preachers. I had Preacher of the Month. It came out once a month. Preacher of the Month, Businessman of the Month, doing the little, because we had the little neighborhood stores at that time and stuff. And then I would come up to the school, and I got a chance to get some darkroom time in because I, you know, because—
At community?
At community, because mm-hmm. I was no longer, I wasn't a student, right. So, you know, so I would come in late, after hours and all that. A little side note, when I first started doing my own pictures, I would go to Big George's on Stadium Boulevard, mm-hmm. the old Big George's spot. And I had bought a enlarger, what they call it, a Federal. That was the brand name, Federal. It was no more than a 2-pound coffee can with a lens in the bottom of it, basically. And they had this spray developer for black and white pictures. And so I would develop the film in my bathroom. Well, I would load it in my closet, develop it in the bathtub, you know, by rinsing it and, you know, sending it through the water and all that, and then hanging it on the curtain rod to dry. After it was dry, I cut it up, and I'd take it on down to Ivory Photo, and then I'd have them make contact sheets for me. That's wow. the way I started doing that, and until I got a chance to get to a dark room and really work things out. When we jump up years later to Pioneer High School, I didn't want to take a science course, so I said, well, photography, I'll take photography. I think her name was Ann Shermetiki. I know her last name was Shermetiki, but I think her first name might have been Ann. If you're 12 weeks, you got to get through your first 9 weeks, and then you're assigned a camera. And academically, the way she ran that class and taught, I just wasn't getting it. I'm what you might call a natural shooter. You know, it's all about exposing light to film, but the way she taught, I just wasn't grasping it. And a lot of students weren't grasping it either. So I failed it, believe it or not. But I didn't let that deter me. Kmart on Maple Road, which is now torn down, mm-hmm. or some other business, multiple yeah. businesses now, they had some books about photography, how to shoot, how to develop film, how to take good pictures, well-exposed pictures and stuff like that. And I would go home and I would get these books and I would go home and read them and spend like, you know, a couple hours in the evening or so just thumbing through the books, reading, looking at the images, learning about f-stops and all of that because I was determined I want to do it and do it right. Mm-hmm. And so color film was starting to come on, you know, then you had a lot of one-hour places and so forth. But Cecil had expressed to me, you know, you get a good working bag, and we call a working bag is having at least two bodies and an assortment of lenses and flash units. Because now you are able to go out and shoot just about anything, and you've got a variety of lenses to get different perspective. Well, through all of that, from Model Cities, I met the late Dr. Potts, who was the director, who eventually became the director of Model Cities. And then he was going to, eventually he was going to leave there and go and work as a ombudsman for the Ann Arbor Public Schools. Mm-hmm. Well, here I am, a young man going out doing stuff. And he told me, he says, hey, Larry, he says, you know, you all, he said, I might have a spot for you, you know, if, you know, certain things are happening within the school system, and he said, I might have a spot for you. Well, seeing that Model Cities was funded by the federal, was part of the city, but funded by the federal government, we had gotten a 30-day notice, I think, once. So I decided, well, I get in contact with him, seeing if that offer is still open. Now, before I came to the news, I worked at Criminal Justice Institute in Detroit. And I did photography, still photography, and I did video work. And that's when video, like tape machines, reel-to-reel, 2-inch broadcast tape, you know, and eventually it got down to 1-inch and then 1/2 inch and 3/4. You know, mm-hmm. things started getting smaller because of electronics and all that kind of stuff. But and I had an application in at the Ann Arbor News. It had been there as far as I know, I had fill out that app at least almost 2 years before I got hired. and happened to see Richard Walker one day. He told me he was going to be leaving because I had kind of hung out at the Ann Arbor News. So I knew Cecil, I knew Jack Stubbs, I knew X Stanger, who ran the department, and then Richard Walker. And one day I was kind of hanging out downtown and seeing Jack. And Jack said, "Hey, man, Richard Walker's going to be leaving." I said, "Yeah, I kind of heard that." He says, "You ought to come up there, man. And, you know, you've been shooting. I've seen your work. You know, Cecil, and Cecil's crazy about you and so forth." I said, "Well, okay, well." And unbeknownst to him, I had already had an application in about 2 years sitting up there. So I went and made contact and did the interview and got interviewed by Cecil and by Dave Bishop, who was one of the editors at the time, and got hired. Came there with maybe a 5-year plan and ended up being 32 years.
All right. And that was 76.
76.
Okay. Do you remember the first photo of yours that got published in the paper? Was it before you worked at the news officially or?
No, the first photo of mine that got published in the paper was when I officially got hired. March 30th of 1976. It was a long time. What my first picture was that got published, I'm not sure. That's if you look in your files and see, because you know how I kept my records. You have to, anything after March 30th, that would be early pictures of mine. Now, one of the more memorable ones was the one of the kid who was a graduate of Pioneer, and they used to line everybody up in Michigan Stadium, and they were out throwing a frisbee around. And I had a nice shot of him running with his stacked heel shoes at the time, bell bottoms, and what you call the graduate headpiece.
Yeah, the mortarboard.
Mortarboard in his hand and reaching up to catch the frisbee, you know. And black and white images, you know, at that time.
So how did the photo department run when you got there? Like, how would you get assignments?
Well, we were down in the basement of the building, and we either go upstairs, editorial was on the third floor, and we'd go up there, and there would be a box with the assignments on them. And depending on what shift you had, then certain things would come your way. I worked the day shift for 30 days, and every 30 days it would change. I worked the day shift, which was like 7 to maybe 3 or so, and then the afternoon shift, which would be like 2 to 10. So that way, because we, especially during, and we couldn't, since me and Bob Chase were the last hired, we were the only ones who had to make that change. We were younger, too, on the staff because Jack and Cecil didn't they didn't have to do that unless they just wanted to cover certain games. So we would switch. So you have 30 days on and 30 days off. And basically, we can only take our vacation when we work in the day shift. But we go upstairs and we get our assignments, and then it'll tell us a business or a new business is opening on such and such a street at such and such a location, and we go there, and sometimes a reporter would be there. Sometimes we didn't have to have a reporter, so we can get a shot. So if they're baking something or if they're fixing bicycles or putting together packages to send to troops somewhere or something like that, you know, it was our discretion on what we shot, the photographer. Mm-hmm. Nobody's telling us what to shoot. Now, we would run into a few problems with some reporters. You need to get that shot. And so we just tell the bosses, and bosses would say, "Hey, look, we don't tell you how to write. You don't tell us how to shoot." And that's how we handle it. And we would give them a variety of pictures. So the desk who was going to make that decision about what's going to appear in the paper, they had a variety of stuff. But and that's how we handled it. Breaking news, they kept a scanner in the newsroom. "Hey, man, you know, we got a barricaded gunman in such and such place. Okay, hey, grab your stuff and you go." And you get what you can. A lot of times if you can get there before all the police people get there, you can get some stuff that's before they start moving you back and all mm-hmm. that. But And I knew a lot of the cops, some of them by first name. So a lot of times I would get there before any other photographers. Because you have to understand now, our competition was like Ipsy Press in terms of local, but basically Free Press and the Detroit News.
Sure.
And they'd have to – now they got to send somebody up here, especially if the event is big enough and it's going to last a while. But by that time, okay, if I'm first on the scene and I know Officer Dye, and that's D-Y-E, a lot of times, too, you know, don't step on nothing. You know, you can stand over here. Okay, now when the rest of these guys come, you know, I'm going to have to move you back. Okay. Also, hey, you know, we're the hometown paper.
Yeah, right.
So you got to take advantage of some of those things.
So what, and you would get tips probably from the public.
Yes.
Too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
So what would you say, what, in a general sense, what were you looking for in a photograph? What did you want to capture?
Well, I wanted to capture something that's going to tell the story when people first look. I want it to hit you when you first look at it, that you don't have to ask a whole lot of questions to yourself about what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's going on here. You know, you have some idea what's happening here, unless I'm doing something on a Peter Max art gallery type stuff. I don't know if y'all know about Peter Max. So, oh, my. Okay. He was a way out there artist. And sort of like Andy Warhol with the soup can and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I enjoyed Peter Max's work. Because like I said, it was kind of out there. You had to kind of figure out, okay. But, you know, like I said, you want to take a picture that's going to tell the story. Now, we did photo pages. So now you got something that's got multiple pictures on the page that can tell even a better story than just the one single shot. But if it's going to be the single shot, cause that's why we all – you never want to turn in just one picture. Mm-hmm. Especially of a big event.
Right.
You want to give them a variety of stuff to choose from. And then that depends on how they're going to – when they look at it, how they're going to edit. Now, those things like that were beyond our control, you know. But if you got good stuff to begin with, hopefully you won't mess it up.
Sure.
Did they tell you ahead of time sometimes? They'd say, we're planning on using three shots of this or whatever. Or would they just take
it? Every now and then they're saying, well, you know what? Depending on how this thing shakes out, we're going to use multiple photos. Okay? So that way we'll know, turn in a lot of stuff. You know, film is cheap. So you take a lot of you can make more work for yourself too. But, you know, you can come back with like six rolls of film or so from an event or a situation. But then again, you got to look through all of that and try and edit your stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Before you give it to them. So, I mean, do I really want to look through six, seven, eight rolls of film that I know only about three pictures if it's going to be something like that going to appear? Or depending on where it's going to be, if it's a fold out, it could be up to nine pictures. A lot of times it's going to be down to four or six. They're going to run one big main picture. And a lot of times, too, you were shooting for stuff that's in advance, too,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be coming up on Sunday or Saturday or near a holiday. Or something like that. We did a lot of stuff pre-holiday, so it can run in the Christmas Day's paper, New Year's Day, certain things like that. As long as we got heads up on it, and or might need to follow up on it. Maybe they're doing something this day, but something else is coming later on that's going to be that can help the story. So you're doing it. You might be at the same place, or you might be doing somebody else out in Dexter, who's going to be associated with this, or they're going to be part of that story.
So I imagine there were times when they'd send multiple photographers out then. And
yes.
Was there a sense of competition? Was it fun competition?
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I noticed, I'm going to tell you right now, when it came, my football was my favorite.
Uh-huh.
Okay. When I left the news, I suffered with withdrawals from from not being able to shoot football, being on the field and traveling to the bowl games and stuff like that. But I noticed that when we would shoot, like, a lot of times, it would be Jack Stubbs would show up. Cecil every now and then, but he was the boss of the department by that time. So, you know, he can pick and choose what he wanted to do, what games he wanted to cover. So a lot of times it was me and Jack. Bob Chase would show up sometime, but Bob Chase really didn't he could take it or leave it. He really didn't have, you know, that much about football, shooting football, and being bothered with the crowd and all that other kind of stuff. Me, I ate it up. So I noticed that when we shoot a lot of stuff, and even some of the people who strung with us and stringers and stuff like that, when the pictures come out in the next day's paper, Jack's stuff would be like front and center. Our stuff would be inside on the fold, you know, moderate size and smaller. And I'm like, and so I watched Jack one day, and Jack, there's a certain shots that he would get that he of his that he would really like. And it was something that he really liked. He would make it not an 8x10. He would print it on 8x11. Okay. And then he'd give him the smaller ones, like, you know, the 8x10 ones. But that big one, the 11x14, he'd give them. And I got to thinking. I said, now, I got skills. I know I can shoot. And I know I got some stuff that's telling the story. And so I started printing certain shots that I really like, you know, especially if it was a key play in the games. Mm-hmm. And then my stuff started running big. They guess, oh, man, Larry. And then some of the sports reporters would say, man, yeah, man, I'm glad you gave us that. Because, you know, because Jack does it all the time. But, you know, you had the shot, man, and you gave it to us and it was big, you know. Okay, cool. I didn't say nothing, but, you know, hey, okay.
You learned.
There's salesmanship in all
yes.
jobs.
Right? Yes, yes, yes.
So it sounds like. It, certainly in terms of, like, you talked about, you know, getting tips from different people, from cops and things like that. Mm-hmm. Sounds like relationships are part of this job. How much of being a good photographer, in your opinion, is the technical aspect of how to take a good shot and frame a good shot, and how much of it is about relationships and being able to talk to the people who you're shooting and understanding what they're doing?
Well, at that time, you know, I'll say it like this. People used to ask me, by being a news photographer and a staff photographer at that, what's the best camera? And I said, well, you know, you stick with your major brands. You know, you got your Nikons, your Pentaxes. I carried the Rolls-Royce of 35mm, and I carried Leicas. Mine were not rangefinders. Mine were SLRs. And the single lens reflex, that's what that. And then, matter of fact, when I first got to the news, I think all of us had some form of Leica cameras. Cecil and myself, we had the SLRs, and Bob Chase and Jack Stubbs had the rangefinders. And about a year after I came, they got lights, Leica enlargers, which made it even better because of the glass, okay? But I said that to say that I would let people know I wasn't trying to push any particular brand. I say, stick with your major brands. I said, all of them got good glass. I said, but you need to get out and shoot. Now, there's some people who like to do the academic thing and be taught and shown and all that. To me, I'm not going to knock it. I didn't go to school for it. It's just that I see things, and that's the way I saw it, and that's how I recorded the event. The technical part, I knew, well, like, let's say, look at when I first came and started out, I've had some of my earlier cameras were, still cameras were Instamatic Reflex, Kodak Instamatic Reflex. And I remember when I was helping Cecil at one of the games, he looked at me and looked at my camera, you know, okay. And here it is. He's changing his film, and I'm able to shoot now on the fourth quarter. And all I do is pull out a cartridge, pump one out, pop another one in, and I keep shooting. You know, it had changeable lenses, telephoto lenses, the whole shot. Only thing is was Instamatic film, which was similar in size to 35mm. They went on the same reel when you develop it, all of that. But just, you know, it was a square frame instead of more of a rectangular frame. You see what you like and you try to record it. you know, try not to overprocess it. Now, there's people who want to be artsy, and there's nothing wrong with that. But you still need to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And now, if we ran enough stories about certain things and we're playing it really straight, maybe it's time to be artsy, or at least some of the stuff that you turn in, you give them that choice. And a lot of times that choice will win out, because they, especially if they've done certain stories enough times, and now they want a picture to go with it,
yeah.
You know. Did I answer your question?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then knowing people also, you know, photographers, we're like a fraternity, so to speak. You know, we talk and we see each other, even though we're competitors. You know, I knew guys from the Free Press and from the news, some from even some of the smaller publications. People who come on Celine and some gazettes and, you know, depending on where we're at, what event we're at. But, you know, you still want to get a shot. You still want your stuff to be – and we're to be put in the paper or published.
Mm-hmm.
Even bigger still, if you got the shot of a big event and AP would call up sometime because they're sending their people, Associated Press and UPI – United Press International would have their people at certain events. Sometimes not everybody got the shot. You got it.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, okay, well, look here. Because we were already affiliated with Associated Press, AP, and UPI. So your shot can go viral, as we say now.
Mm-hmm.
But it would go worldwide. It'd go international. You know, nationwide, international, depending on, you know, because you got the shot where everybody else didn't quite get that moment.
Mm-hmm. So that happened on the in some of the sports?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. More than once.
Pretty fun to see those.
Oh, yeah. Open up the paper or I look over at the wire service and I see my stuff coming over the wire or it's being printed in one of the papers. Hey, you better hope and know that. Pump your chest on that
one.
So how much of getting the shot is luck? Is snapping at just the right second?
Well, timing. Luck, if you want to call it luck, okay, I call it timing.
Okay.
And this was during a time before motorized mm-hmm. cameras, where you had a motor drive, where you can, you know, so a lot of it, so a lot of times too, now you have to understand too now, I'm using my own equipment at first. The news started buying equipment later on. So basically a lot of mine was single shots. Now I'm shooting as fast as I can, but I'm hitting the button each time I'm taking a picture.
Right.
Where some of those guys from either the bigger papers or had deeper pockets, they had motor drives on their camera. But that's still not a guarantee that you're gonna get. You can get that peak moment be just before it or after it.
Mm-hmm.
Now if I'm doing my shots, so I learn how to wait on it. So you know when I think I got it, you know, boom, I hit the shutter and you know hopefully I got it. I never bragged about what I got. A lot of times I say, I think I got it. I got, you know, because I got to get back to the dark room and develop it and see if I did. And if I did, man, you'll hear me holler, hey, y'all, think I got it.
So let me ask you about the process then. So you take your shots and how quickly would you come back? Where did you work in the news to develop? Where was the dark room? And, mm-hmm. and you know, how did things work after?
Well, the dark room was in the basement at the time.
Okay.
When I first came, we had about four dark rooms in the basement. And they're all set up with the fan ventilation and all that, but it still wasn't enough. I mean, that chemistry from trade development and stuff was strong. I never put my hands in it. I always used gloves and tongs. But you shooting, if I came in and I had about four different assignments, they wouldn't see me till, you know, later on when I come back. And I went down, started developing my stuff, started printing the shots, you know, setting them up to the dryer so they can dry. And then, you know, typing up some kind of caption, taping that to the back or to the bottom of the picture so they'll have it and then send it upstairs. That's how that came about.
And can you talk a little bit about how the technology changed over those 32 years?
Oh,
what it felt like?
Oh,
what
man. Well, I was always a proponent of the digital age. I seen it coming. I knew. I said, man, this is going to be huge. Some of it was for selfish reasons, too. I'm kind of not necessarily a techie, but I am kind of a techie. And I like to see how things work, how they come apart, how they go back together. And I like to keep records. I like to keep tabs on what's happening and how it's happening. So when the things start to change, we had the we had machines that could do it automatically. And we started out with a machine that developed the film. So we didn't have to, we'd call it dipping and dunking. We didn't have to hand do it. We just load it up, put in these containers, put it on machine, program machine, and the machine would develop it. After that, we put it in. We had these dryers mounted on the walls and put the reels in the dryer. And then you can go into the darkroom after the film is dry and pick out your pick, put it in larger, and start making your prints. Now, later on, we could do that. Eventually, things came about where we had a scanner. And you put your film in the scanner, and it would scan it in, and the image would come up on the screen. So, because that was hooked to like a laptop. Our first ones were, we had Apple stuff. So, like the Nikon, they had a Nikon scanner and stuff like that. And then you can work with your picture and you know, do the same things you do in the darkroom, you know, burning and checking the highlights and make sure it's not too blown out and all that kind of stuff. And for color stuff, you didn't have to do that much, but you did a lot more preparing ahead of time with your lighting, because I use lights with umbrellas to kind of soften it and different things depending on what I'm shooting. If it's something that we set up, and that type of thing. We were shooting at the time before the news made the conversion to total color. They had us shooting black and white film and color film. So color slide film, transparency. And a lot of times, like I said, we got two bodies. But sometimes you'd have that peak shot, that shot on one and not the other. And then when they're looking at stuff, they say, oh, man, do you have this in color? You know, and so, you know, we tell them, hey, look, you know, but the news was slow to make that move. And I don't know if it was a corporate decision because we were owned by Newhouse or Ann Arbor News's decision. You know, I didn't know that and I didn't inquire much about that. You know, I just say, you know, try to stay in my lane and this is what you want. This is what we got. But eventually we went to color negative. And they had, you know, you got your separations, cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. So eventually when we did like the slides and stuff like that, okay, you can do it in color, shoot it all in color, and they'll just take the magenta slide and that would be the black and white picture that would appear in the paper if they want to run it in black and white. Mm-hmm. Other than that, then they had the others to make the color. The interesting thing was being on the road. That was fun. I would carry a stainless steel suitcase looking thing that had the scanner in it, built in it with a screen, a little small 4x5 screen. And AP was safe. We were on the road doing an event, especially sports. They would have people ahead of time set up and running the lab. And all of us, since we were members with AP, they would have runners who come out and collect our film. And we had these pouches and we would label our film. So, well, I had a little stamp I put on Larry E. Wright, Ann Arbor News, so they don't get my stuff mixed up with anybody else's. And then by halftime when we come in, our stuff would be dried and hanging up. We come in, pick it out, and look at certain shots and start sending it back to the newsroom. Now, in the early days, it would take a half hour to send a color project, the cyan, magenta, and yellow, okay, to send it back to the news. And they had a machine that would pull up all three copies, and then they had to do some however they do it downstairs with the print shop folks. That's the way it was done. Wow. Eventually, and if they told me it was going to be some black and white stuff, then all I had to do is just send. It would take 10 minutes Okay. But yeah, a half hour. That's and you could see it as it scanned it. It just it was amazing. So therefore, the bigger papers who had the deeper pockets, you know, they were able – they had machines that were a little faster. So I remember shooting a Rose Bowl game, and I was there till like 2 o'clock in the morning, California time. And it's 5 o'clock in the morning, our time here. And my photo editor, it wasn't Cecil by that time, he would be back there receiving my stuff. And he would tell me, okay, man, you got some good stuff here, man. You know, keep sending it, keep sending it, keep sending it. Eventually, I got a chance to get a machine that was what we call a buffer. And so everything would kind of load up in this buffer machine. And so I could keep – I wouldn't have to sit there and wait the half hour. I could just keep sending it, keep loading it up, picking the images.
Wow, we take that for granted today.
Oh, gosh. My God. You look at I had what they call a data bank, Casio data bank, 64 KB. And I thought I was living the vida loca. And one of our IT guys, he said, man, you know what? You got more memory in that than we had downstairs when we were running the newsroom on racks. Racks. Didn't have that much.
Yeah, you saw all that.
Yeah.
Do you have are there shots that stick out in your mind, particular shots?
I knew you were going to ask me that eventually. Well, the one I talked about earlier was the kid at the graduation. The Anthony Carter shot that came along when he had this ball that could have put the game away for Michigan against Ohio State. And just off his fingertips and stuff like that. But I had a lot of stuff through, you know, we talk about just over 3 decades. I had a lot of stuff. A lot of it was the sports stuff that I remember. But I had some feature. We used to go in between assignments. If I got about 4 assignments or 3 assignments or 2 assignments when I came in, plus we had a phone, they can call us. Well, we had pagers at that time. And what I did, especially at that time when we had, since we had pagers, cell phones weren't around at that time. Matter of fact, when we did get cell phones, it was a big box, maybe about an 8x10 in size and about 2 inches thick, heavy, with the, like you see at home with your phone receiver on the hook, that kind of style that you hold up to your ear. Oh, man. And the button would be in that hand unit. Okay, that's how you call. And so what I did, I figured this out myself. I said, well, I'm not running around with change in my pocket. And the phone would sometimes work. And, you know, you got this big antenna behind you, whipping you up in the head and carrying on. I learned that, found out that the news had 2 800 numbers. Yes. One went to sports and one went to advertising. But if you called either one, they could transfer you to who you need to go to. And I found that out. I didn't say that much to anybody else about it. So when I'm out there in the field and I'm doing something and I got a question, I call that 800, hey, man, transfer me to so-and-so in sports, or transfer me to the photo editor, or transfer me to so-and-so. That's the way I did it.
That's smart. I have a question here. Do you remember taking this?
Oh, Elvis Presley?
One of the last photos.
I meant to look this up to find out. When I took this, I think it was April.
Yeah. April 25th.
But you can
that's when it ran.
You can look it up and find out when he passed.
It was just a few months later.
It wasn't, but
August. I think it was August.
It's a few short months later. But I remember I was married at the time. It was a Saturday, I believe. It was a Saturday or a Sunday, which was kind of unusual. But he came, and I believe it was at Chrysler Arena. Yeah, it was at Chrysler Arena. And I got a shot to get a chance to shoot Elvis Presley, and the backup singers were the Sweet Sensations. Those were his backup singers. And during the early days at the news, for years, we had to do our own reprints. People could get pictures from the paper that were printed in the paper. And so we had to do the reprints. So, you know, and you know, grandma, granddad, whatever, would see pictures of their kids or whatever in the paper for something like a play or whatever, or, you know, people, some business or whatever, they liked this picture and they would order. So these orders would come through and we had to make time to make these pictures. Well, when I took the pictures of Elvis Presley, I had three boxes. I put in, I make about 100 pictures each of whatever appeared in the paper. So since they ran about four, because there's this one here, but they ran another one on the back, mm-hmm. Back page or something like that. So they ran about four pics. Because I know, you know, Elvis Presley, I mean, you know, it's going to be, and a bunch of orders came in. And I didn't have to worry about going in the dark room, spending all that extra time, printing up all these shots. I had them. Boom, I just put them together, get them out to the promotion folks, and they can send them out. But Elvis Presley, I enjoyed shooting that. That was fun.
It looks like it.
He came to and Chrysler Arena was the venue at the time. I got some pictures in my album at home of Ike and Tina Turner, but that was before I came to the news too. When they came to Chrysler Arena, Aretha Franklin, when she came to Chrysler Arena, matter of fact, she did a set that was a real good set, and then she broke for intermission. People thought that was the end of the show. So when she came back out, noticed the place had kind of cleared up, but, you know, people standing around waiting for maybe autographs or whatever. She came out in the middle and got sat down by the piano, played the piano a little bit, and talked to people just like we're talking right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how did the culture of the news change over the time you were there?
When you say the culture of the news, what do you mean?
I mean sort of the makeup of the staff, and when you came into the news, a daily newspaper was still pretty much everybody still subscribed to the daily newspaper.
That's
and
true.
When you left the news, daily newspapers were in the process of dying.
Yes.
So what was that experience like? Did you know it was happening? Could everyone feel that it was happening?
Well, we could feel the change was in the wind, especially once you went to digital. When I left the news, we were on our second generation of digital cameras. But when we started doing web stuff, you know, not doing the normal routine of stuff, but now we're doing web stuff, which I enjoyed. I enjoyed it. But then you hear about other papers kind of folding or being bought up and then closed and stuff like that. So you kind of knew something was in the wind here. Something was going on. And I remember in 2006, and I was kind of going through some things, especially my late mom. She had Alzheimer's, and I'm an only child, so I was trying to get caregivers to come in and take care of her and while I worked, and then I'd do it in the evenings. But I was doing a lot of praying, and I felt something was in the wind. And I remember telling Bob Chase, I said, Bob, because Bob had two more years at the news than me. I said, I don't know what's going on, man, but I think there's something in the wind, and we probably need to get our bills paid up and paid off. And who realized that February 6, 2007, I get a call from my editor. And Larry, I'm going to give you a heads up before you get back, because I was out in the field shooting my assignments. The publisher came upstairs with a list of 44 names on it for a buyout offer. And I said, well, okay, thank you. And then after I finished talking to him, I said, well, thank you, Lord. That kind of answers my questions. Because that year prior to 2006 and maybe 2006, we had a real bad storm. Knocked out a lot of power in southern Michigan, upper Ohio, and so forth. So it blackout a couple of days. And so we couldn't do anything at the downtown location of the news because we got the printer. The big printing press is there and all that. But by that time, they done built the off-site printing press on State Road that printed New York Times. They had two printers in there. So one printed New York Times and one printed the Ann Arbor News. So our IT department set up a long table out there, and that's where we went. Because by that time, we're doing all digital. We're shooting digital cameras. We got laptops. The reporters got laptops. the editors, they got laptops so they can see the stuff and make their edit. You know, y'all, everything is, you know, it's, I won't call it cookie cutter, but you know what size the paper is going to be. And the paper got a little smaller itself, too. But I remember making a point of it to stand up when all of us are in that room and around the table, to stand up and just kind of look around. I do remember that. I wanted to make sure I received this moment. And figure, I said, man, we've got all that building downtown. Even though the news, the downtown building was being renovated and they were upgrading the T1 lines and doing something to some of the other rooms and stuff. And I said to myself, I thought to myself, we don't need all that building downtown. We're putting the paper out right here.
Right at the table.
Right at the table. The editors, photographers, the reporters, we're all doing our job and things are right there. You had a 1,000-gallon tank and a 500-gallon tank to run the presses out there. I don't know if it was gas or diesel fuel or what, you know, to run things. But, yeah, that's the way it was.
Did you want to follow up on that? Or sticking with the culture of the news, mm-hmm. it's was a pretty conservative paper.
Oh, you think?
Yeah. Well, I found this. I was curious what if you wanted to talk a little bit about that and if it's an editorial that you helped write.
Oh, my. You. Yes.
Curious what you thought. Like, were there any repercussions for that? Were there?
No.
Or can you explain what it is since people—
It was a commentary. I'd have to read the whole thing to refresh my memory because this was back in when?
So that was 1985, I think. I can't read the date in the file. 88, I think, is
was
what
it 1988?
It
says.
88, yeah.
Yeah, and it was an you were calling out the news for supporing the it looks like an editorial written by U of M's Dean Peter Steiner.
Uh-huh.
And we'd mentioned views, you know, basically some comments that were rather racist. And
yes.
I'm kind of curious how that.
Well, we got together because we were part of the Association of Black Journalists. And we figured that we need to be some kind of rebuttal to this. And that's how we came up with it. And because we are part of an organization, the news did not penalize us. I did my job without any repercussions in that. And they did. They looked it over real well. Okay. Keith Owens was a editor. And the other guy, Calvin Lawrence, he was also a reporter editor type at the paper. And so we got together and that's how we came up with a rebuttal. To that, and I was glad that the news printed it. Very conservative paper, yes. Some good people to work with, especially, you know, when I came, you know, well, Cecil Lockhart, being an African American and running the photo department of the Ann Arbor News, you know, that was like, for us in the community, that was a big deal. I remember my late father, he was so proud that I had landed the job at the Ann Arbor News. I mean, the city I grew up in, I was raised in here, and, you know, and here his son is, you know, taking pictures and stuff is on front page, you know, exposés, and they're sending me out to cover games and traveling here and there and, you know, stuff like that. He was really proud. But it also opened up a lot of things where people didn't know who I was. They knew the name. They seen the name in the paper repeatedly. But a lot of people didn't know I was black. And so when I come certain places for certain assignments, people look at me, and you are. And I made it a point. We all had Ann Arbor News IDs. But I always made it a point to wear mine clipped to my collar. I had a certain, I hate to say this, but a swag or panache about myself, how I represent. I wore a shirt and tie.
to all your assignments?
I was probably the only photographer, unless there was something really special coming up that they tell you. They would tell the photographer, you know, you might want to wear something for this event because it's a ball or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I, as routine, I wear a shirt and tie. I'm a professional. I wanted to be treated like a professional. And so therefore, and I'm going to carry myself accordingly because of who I work for and who I represent. And so when I would come and some people would see me, it would help me out on some situations because some people think they get a little nervous. Now, I'm coming with a full regalia of cameras like all the other photographers. But for some reason, you know, who are you? And so I would use it to my advantage. Sometimes they say, well, I say, well, my name is Larry E. Wright. I'm with the Ann Arbor News. Can you show me what the, you know, and so, oh, yeah, come this way. And a lot of times while they're so busy trying to find out who I am and helping me, I'm ahead of some of the other guys and starting to get my shot. So that was good. Then I had, in the early days, some challenges with fellow photographers. You at that time, you did not have a whole lot of African-American photographers working at major newspapers. So a lot of times my colleagues who were white, they would see me. Now, we're at an event. We're waiting in line or we're in a room. We're waiting for a certain event to start or we're lined up or whatever. And they, well, who are you? And a lot of times just because of who I am, I'd say, well, I'm Larry Wright and I'm with the Ann Arbor News. And I put my hand out to, you know, shake. Oh, okay. So, you know, through the years, it happened enough times that I, you know, I shouldn't have to explain who I am. My tag is here. I got the cameras like everybody else. I'm doing pictures. And I said, so one guy, and I'm an easy-go-lucky type person. It doesn't take a whole lot to rattle me. It takes a while. But other than that, even when I see certain things that ain't right, but, you know, Lord help them, we'll get through this. And so one guy came with me one day and, hey, who are you? And I didn't say it right away. I just looked at him for a few moments. I said, well, who are you? And he said, oh, I'm sorry. He says, I'm so-and-so. And he put his hand out, and I said, well, I'm Larry Wright with Ann Arbor News. And, you know, and now we can talk. You know, but I'm a professional. I'm here on assignment. I'm not, no, just Larry just got off the bus. Just got off the bus from AATA and came in for an assignment, you know. Eventually a lot of people learned who I was and you know. And they liked my work and, you know, I get tips. And like I said, people will call and, you know. And like I said, I'm being from Ann Arbor. I knew the town. I knew the city. I went to a lot of the politicians and stuff like that. Went to school with a lot of their kids and so forth. So I knew the area. And so that would help. That also helped, you know. And then you asked about earlier, something you asked about helping out with tips and certain things like that. Well, we get some new reporters, and they got an assignment, and it just so happened that I'm the photographer assigned to be with them to get a picture of whatever. And they will get an assignment, let's say it's about the advancement of hemoglobin and how you look at it through a microscope and figure out the white cells and the blue cells or whatever, you know. I've got a lot of varied interests. I used to work at medical science in the evening when I was in junior high, cleaning up the labs. And we had a machine that did the pipettes and the flask and all that kind of equipment and all that. So I would ask a lot of questions. So here we are years later, and I'm listening to this person. They're kind of struggling a little bit because the person is starting to say things, and they're not. And so every now and then I'm getting pictures now at the same time. And I say, well, you know, can I ask you a question? They say, what? I say, well, what about blah, 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 this and so? And the reporter would say, yeah. So, and a lot of times when I get back to the office, that reporter would come up to me, hey, I'm glad you were there because I didn't know what to ask this person. After I got a certain list of questions, you know, I didn't, you know, but you were right. He's like, you knew all about, you know. I said, well, you know, we got through that. You know, but we're colleagues. We're, you know, I didn't expect everybody to know everything about everything that they do a story on.
Right.
you know, some things it's going to be just like it's new to everybody else. It's going to be new to them. And how I would ask simple type of questions. That way I know that reporter can get it and be able to break it down so our average reader would be able to understand it. Now, Ann Arbor is fairly affluent community, mm-hmm. very, very savvy intelligence and the internet when that came along and all that kind of stuff. So Ann Arbor can kind of figure things out. But, you know, let's not leave it to chance.
Were you a photographer or a photojournalist? And what's the difference?
I considered myself a photojournalist if you're going to pigeon me. But other than that, when I introduced myself, I was a photographer. When I did anything, I was a photographer. Whatever I did, because I did mass communications with images, to me, it's all about light and exposure to light. So, and telling a story. So I considered myself a photographer telling a story with the images that I recorded through the camera lens. Now, if you want to say photojournalists, fine. And I did write stories. We did our own picture pages and wrote, and I had my stuff edited by everybody else. So in that respect, okay, I'll put on the photojournalist hat. But other than that, it's all, you know, you got to get the caption. I have a pet peeve in today's world, especially with the internet, because people believe just about anything that comes across the internet. And nothing gets edited, hardly. It just boggles my mind, the stuff that's out, misspellings and pronunciations and pronouns and nouns and just, and you call yourself reputable? And I won't get political, so I won't talk about anybody in the high offices.
Well, so one thing I got to ask, you know, being a librarian and having inherited the entire mm-hmm. Collection of the clippings and the photo negatives from the news, we've had now nearly a decade of working with this material, mm-hmm. and you kept a pretty, you know, pretty well organized collection, mm-hmm. and I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about some of the ways that your colleagues handled their
some of my colleagues, as you probably noticed when you went through the files, some things were labeled correctly and some things were just kind of happenstance and hodgepodge. But like I told you earlier, I have a certain way that I carry myself. There's a certain way that I do things. And not knowing who might look at this years later, that was my thinking. Mm-hmm. So I would file my pictures, and a lot of times I would put the clippings in or the page in that it appeared on. And then I would notch the negative or the slide or the color negative. That way, if someone looks at it and they want to do a reprint, or they knew the image that printed in the paper, but maybe there was something else that they wanted to print that was along that line. Now, I'm not sure how Cecil did his. Nobody was better organized than I was. I'll put it like that. Now, Jack Stubbs, I have seen it happen more than once. They come in from the newsroom. Hey, the story you did, we need some more pictures of this such and such event. And Jack was kind of slow to file his negatives, and he'd keep them in a big box. And he'll eventually go through them and then fill out the envelope and all. Nobody clipped their stuff and the clippings that ran with the picture and all that like I did. But I've seen it happen more than once. Somebody came in from the newsroom, and he's, and Jack would say, and a few choice words. I don't know what the picture is, and maybe it might be in this box. And he'd reach his hand into this big box. It's like having a big box with worms just kind of moving around. So it's a big box of just negatives. And he'd reach in there, and he'd say, I don't know, and he'd pull out a negative. And lo and behold, it's the negative of what they want on it.
Amazing.
And I have seen that happen more than once. And I'm thinking like, But Hey, it worked for him.
Well, we want to publicly thank you for how well organized your stuff
is. It's very helpful to us.
It's really helpful.
Oh, that's funny. But you never know who's going to look at your stuff. And I didn't find out until after I had left the news they were going to send their catalogs to the Ann Arbor Public Library. Ann Arbor District Library,
yeah.
You know, and I'm glad they did. The one thing I am sorry about, though, is that a lot of my sports stuff that I shot with U of M, and, you know, we got over three decades of stuff. And, I mean, I covered numerous Rose Bowl games. I covered the Gator Bowl. I covered the Alamo Bowl down in Texas, Citrus Bowl. I've been all over the country, and not just for sports. They sent me to Terre Haute, Indiana, to the federal penitentiary.
Yeah.
In Terre Haute, Indiana, yes. There was a story me and Jim Kane were working on, and he found out about this guy who was serving time in the penitentiary, who was a Vietnam veteran. Pilot. This guy, he ran drugs. Okay. Long story short. And he was so good, he could land a DC-9 on a grass field at midnight with no moon. They would have to, when he was running drugs in and out of the country, they would have to, when he was going to do the drop or do the pickup, whichever, they'd have to remind him to pick up his money. He just liked it for the thrill of it. The thrill, you know, I guess, you know, being that he was a war vet, you know, doing this, I mean, that probably kept his adrenaline going. And what ended up happening, I think he said it was either the CIA or the FBI, they got a hold and they were able to pay people off on one of his drops. And that way, that's how he got busted when he landed. But he was able to come in and out of the United States underneath the radar.
Wow.
So that's how good he was.
And this was down – was there an Ann Arbor connection?
He was convicted in the federal court here in Ann Arbor.
Gotcha.
And sent – you know, well, yeah. Federal, they can send you anywhere, you know, in terms of serving your time.
Wow.
Yes, that was –
that sounds like fun.
I've taken pictures of governors like Milliken and all the different governors through the years. I've taken pictures of Desmond Tutu. That one time when Bill Clinton visited, he came into Willow Run Airport, you know. Those are times when you can't get close, so you got to put on your long lenses, you know, and because they've got a spot for press photographers and, you know, everybody's, you know, it's not a new shot because everybody's going to get the same thing unless you're in the pool. And so I got the shots of him. I've covered court trials, you know, murder, trials were embezzlement, you know, of all kinds of types. One of the sad ones was that I covered was a trial of a friend of mine whose son, who had some mental issues, but anyway, he ended up killing his kid. He broke into a house where the mother of the kid was, and the kid, they lived there. He broke into the house, ran upstairs. It was late at night, and I guess he thought that she would be the one being in the bed, and he ran into the room and, you know, started doing things, and it wasn't her in that bed that particular night. The kid was in the bed. She had got up or fell asleep on the couch or somewhere else or something to that effect. Yeah, and he looked at, as they were leading him through the back way to the courtroom for his arraignment and stuff. He looked up. He happened to look up at me because he was handcuffed and everything. He said, "Oh man," he said, "oh, they sent you, huh?" I said, "I really didn't respond to him. I just kind of looked at him. But I got my shot. I, you know, what can you do?"
It's tough.
And like I said, he was the son of a good friend of mine. We were back when the CB days were. We're going good and all of that, but it was crazy, just crazy. When you asked me earlier about the technology, and I was telling you about how things were changing, we I remember coming through the airport with that case, that same case. And I had a cart, a hand cart, and I had it on with my equipment. And something happened. I was coming down, getting ready to come down the escalator, and it slipped out. And it's taking this tumble, and it's just like slow motion.
No.
Watching it go doom, 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 down the steps. And I picked it up, and so when I did get back to the job, I plugged it in and turned it on, and it came on. I said, oh, thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. It came on, but a few times later after that, it stopped working.
I feel like I don't want to keep you talking because we've been talking for over an hour, but I am willing to bet you have a bunch of if we were to ask you about specific people at the news over the years, one of the things that is one of the things that's strange for us is that, you know, we digitize all this stuff from the newspaper. So we're very interested in the newspaper and how the newspaper works. The newspaper doesn't talk about the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
The news is not the news,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we see bylines. We don't know who these people are.
You
know, we don't understand the process of how a newspaper even gets put together most of the time.
Right.
And it's so strange for us because as outsiders, that's a huge area of interest for
mm-hmm,
us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so like, you know, it'd be great to have you come back and talk,
it would.
Talk about some of those. Talk about Jim Kane and Bill Tremmel and Jack Stubbs and talk more about Cecil. And
well, like I said, some of those folks I work with already had been at the paper when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I met them. But we also did like Jim Kane, the late Jim Kane. We call him Killer. That was our nickname for him because we had a lot of us on after hours, we would play softball together. So we had a softball team called the Green Screens. And we bowled the Green Screens once again. So we softball, Jim Kane with his little short self, he wasn't the very astute softball player, but hey, he got in there and he tried. And from time to time, he'd turn out and he'd do something that was memorable, okay? Even if he was trying to block himself from being hit by a line drive ball and the ball comes into his mitt. So you know, and to see him run, oh my gosh. But and then later on, I was a pitcher for the team. I wore these I wore my green screen shirt, but I had these shorts that just, I thought they were just, you had to have somebody else to describe me with them shorts. Because I'd be on the mound talking a lot of smack. They were striped, vertical stripes, and they were, basically the shorts were white, but the stripes were closer together. They were green, black, green and black stripes on the shorts. And we had our chant, green, and everybody else say screens and green and screens. And then, you know, we go to the bar after the game and all that. But I'd be on the mound talking plenty of spat. And we play against some of these teams that had these good hitters. I mean, we're just a bunch of average folks. And I made it a point to play co-ed teams. I played one year with the guys' team. The guys are just too serious about it. I'm going to have fun. I mean, So and some of the same ones would play on the co-ed team too. But we're playing these teams with these guys, and they got these big muscles, and you know they can jack the ball. And I'm on the mound, and I help us through some games. I'm pitching, and I was a good pitcher, slow pitch, you know. And they wanted to hit this ball so bad just to knock it down my throat, just to shut me up. And I would get them, and they would, some of them get good hits, and some of them, a lot of times, would get a foul tip, and the ball's up in the air, and boom, we done caught that. So that's one of the outs, another out, you know, or the ball would dribble around and stuff, and we grab it, and, you know, got it, you know, so. And one guy, especially the guys who were good sports about it, you know, after the game, especially if they done lost, you know, hey, man, you know what? I wanted to ram that ball down. But you know what? Yeah, you're good for the game. You were hilarious out there, you know. And, you know, like I said, you try not to take it too seriously because it's a game. But, you know, we had fun. We had, and then when the bowling league came about, you know, it was co-ed also. And we you know, we had our real good bowlers. Some of them guys in the sports department were really good bowlers. But every now and then, I'm an average bowler. I'm about like 140, 160. But when I got concentration and I'm on my game, I can get up there close to the 200s and over. And every now and then, oh, man, look at Larry. Larry, is that you, Larry? You know, I'm zoned in, you know. But like I said, we had big fun. We just, you know. But Kane, the other Kane, I want to say Steve Kane. He, I think, grew up in, I want to say, in the Detroit area, Detroit or a suburb of Detroit. He was older than me. Big white guy. I mean, big, tall in stature, broad shoulders. Very astute, very learned person. And him and I were talking about an assignment that we're going to do together. And an assignment that we had had together. And it was a protest of something. Something was going on. I'm trying to remember it was. And I remember Steve saw me and saw the expression on my face. Because you ain't going to, you know, as they say, when you talk about give me my space. And you ain't going to be throwing a whole lot of epithets at me and coming up in my face and you know, because we're going to boogie. Now, people are going to listen. Boogie, what's he? Because it ain't going to go down like that. And I remember Steve coming over saying, hey, no, talking to the guy. He said, because we talked about it later on when we got back to the news. He said, man, I'm from the area. He says, I wasn't even going to let that guy come and try and swing on you. He said, and I seen you were getting kind of, you know, like you were trying to back away from him, but he was trying to press it, and you know, hey. But I was grateful for Steve being there, you know, because that could have went a bunch of different ways.
Sure.
And then my credibility, you know, bottom line, I got to look at how am I going to be perceived at the news, and for those in the public eye who know, because for one, I'm an African American. I work for a newspaper. Okay, and there's certain things that go along with that that people have or misconceptions. And
sure. And
I remember Cecil Lockhart was talking one day. We had a reporter, Zeta Blayton Cambridge, I was out with Zeta on an assignment. He was with some other. He was with a reporter, white female reporter, and he was on campus over by the, remember he was saying, telling me about the State Theater. And him and the reporter had met, they agreed to meet at the spot because they were going to do some one of these things where you stop people on the street and ask them questions.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking, and a guy came up and said, Miss, is this guy bothering you? And I remember Cecil telling that story. Now, Cecil is a Marine vet, and he was an MP in the Marines.
Wow.
And he's big, dark-complected man, and big. He's like Cecil stood probably 6'4".
Wow.
You know, between 6'2 and 6'4". And his brother was the late John Onye Lockhart, the artist. And so I can't imagine this dude running – try to look like, you know, are you Mighty Mouse or something? You go here, you come to save the day, you know. But, you know, you go through them things. You know, like, not everybody's going to like you. And like I said, there were stories we did where, being that I'm from this town and grew up here, we had a situation on Pontiac Trail where a guy I knew, didn't know it at the time until I got there, hit his old lady. You know, and the police were called. So they heard, this is something they heard on the scanner. So, hey, go out. We got an abuse situation between possibly a husband and a wife. We don't know all. So I get out there and the police are out there, you know, so I'm getting a general shot and now I'm trying to focus in on some stuff. And I see them arresting this guy and I get that shot. And then the girl comes out and she sees me and, even though there's some other photographers around. Yeah, Larry White. Oh, yeah, this is news. This is news. And, you know, blah, blah, thus and so, you know. And I'm like, I never responded to her. I never said anything, you know. I just continued to get my shots. And because it comes with the territory. You know, it comes
holding your tongue. You mean just not saying
No, because I don't want to escalate anything. Right. I don't want to be part of the situation and however it's going to go.
Right.
I'm there like any other photographer. This is the news. This is where they sent me.
Right.
You know, but I've worked even some of the guys like I'm trying to think of Keith. I can't remember his name. He's with the Detroit Free Press. He works with the news now, but I don't know if he's still with the paper. But some of them guys, I mean, who started out with the Ann Arbor News or have had in their career some tenure with the Ann Arbor News. Jason Whitlock, who's nationally known and been on TV and all of that, he had his tenure with the Ann Arbor News. And there's a few others, you know, John Bacon, who writes the book. Rick Fitzgerald, who works for University of Michigan, but he was one of the editors at the news. The list goes on and on for people who've gone to other things and who have had careers at the Ann Arbor News.
How does watching the world through a lens and going to the kinds of assignments that you get sent to working for a newspaper change your outlook on the world, change how you perceive the world?
We all are different. And we all have something to offer. I'm one who, when I'm on an assignment, especially dealing with people who speak another language, I ask them things. How do I greet you? How do I say this? How do I say that? You know, there's a few things I can say, you know, ni hao in Chinese, konnichiwa, wadakwadamas in Japanese. And some other languages, too. Just learning how, just, you know, and you'd be surprised how people respond because they feel, okay, you're trying to learn. But we all got problems throughout the world. And we're all doing things, good and bad, throughout the world. So, you know, when I'm covering assignments and I'm meeting people, I try not to make any particular judgments about them and where they're from and all that kind of stuff. I treat you like I like to be treated, you know. More than likely, I'm there for the event because you've agreed to be in the paper, you know, in spite of how the news might play their spin on it, okay? And the news has its agenda on some things, too. Okay, all right, I get that. But in the same breath, I enjoyed what I did. I figured it's got an impact. Naturally, I didn't write the story, so, you know, people either like the story or don't like it. You know, but my picture, there it is, my picture, photo by Larry E. Wright. There was no mistake in that. But I've covered rallies, sit-ins by the at the university, people camping out and all that kind of stuff. And I wish I had been the one that got that picture when the African-American lady, when they were having the Nazi demonstration. And the guy got beat down, and she put her body over his to protect him so everybody wouldn't just come starting to jump on and beat this guy to pulp. You know, I wish I had been the one that got that shot. You know, like I said, you know, you're at these events, and there's so much going on, and you're trying to get it, and somebody else got that. That was a great shot. That went, as they say today, viral. That went worldwide, you know. And matter of fact, she got a lot of press out of that too, because she, here's somebody, the opposites in terms of position, you know, but she put herself in harm's way to protect him because he's a human being. I thought that was major.
AADL Talks To is a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.